Julia Child is widely credited with teaching America about how to think differently about food with her groundbreaking book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and her television show, The French Chef. She would have turned 100 years old on August 15th, and to celebrate her contributions to cooking and culture, we decided to make this month's selection for the Lundeth Lopez Show Book Club her memoir, My Life in France, which she wrote with her grandnephew, Alex Prudhomme. It's published by Knopf, and Mr. Prudhomme, who is a journalist and the author of The Ripple Effect, among other books, joins us now to talk about Julia Child's life, how she learned to cook in France, and how she became a brilliant teacher and writer. And we invite your comments. You can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And some listeners already have, and we'll get to some of them in a little moment. How did you get involved in the writing of this book?
The genesis for this book began in 1969 when Julia's husband, Paul Child, suggested that they publish the letters that Paul and Julia wrote to my grandparents while they were living in France in the late 40s and early 50s. My grandfather, Charles Child, was the twin brother of Paul, and so they were very close. And Julia and my grandmother, Frederica Child, were also very close. So they would write back and forth every week. And they had this very lively correspondence. And unfortunately, the publishers weren't interested in doing the book of letters, but Julia, from that moment on, thought it would be a great idea to do a book about the favorite years of her life.
She wanted to do a memoir.
She wanted to do a book of stories about how she discovered French food and why she thought it was so important.
And how did this collaboration work? You didn't...
She's been talking about this book for years, and it never appeared. And I would always say, Julia, how's the France book coming? That's how she referred to it. And she would say, oh, it's coming along. And, you know, I had my own career as a writer, and I obviously wanted to work with her because she had so many fabulous stories. But she was also very self-reliant and politely declined for a long time. But finally, in December of 2003, I was visiting her in Santa Barbara. And she was 91 years old, and I said, how's the France book coming? And she said, well, dearie, it's not so great right now. And I said, well, I'm here to help. And this time she said, okay, let's try it.
And then she passed away a year later.
Not even a year later. We began to work in January through August of 2004. Her birthday is August 15th, and she passed away on the 13th. 2 days shy of her 92nd birthday. So we'd worked together for 8 months. And then it took me another year beyond that to finish the book. And so that was a challenging period because I had so many questions for her and she wasn't there to answer them. But ultimately, with the help of our editor, Judith Jones, who was the woman who had really discovered Julia, we were able to create this series of narratives, these little vignettes about the best time of Julia's life. And the tone we were trying to get is sort of informal. It's as if you're sitting at a cafe table, maybe having a glass of wine or a cup of coffee, and she's telling you some of her favorite stories. And some of them are long and some of them are short. And it's interesting. People either like to read the book straight through or in little bites. And it's I like that. And I think Julia would like it too.
So part of the problem, if we can call it a problem, was capturing that quality of her voice, a voice that we were all so familiar with.
Very idiosyncratic voice, a lovely voice, both on the written page and in person. The Julia that you saw on television was the real Julia. That's really the way she was when it was just the two of us sitting in a room and she was cracking jokes, but also being very serious about her food. One of the things that I wanted to get through kind of subtly in the book is not only her great charisma and her deep knowledge, but how hard she worked. I don't think people realize that each recipe she would try 10 or 12 times to make sure she'd ironed out all the problems that a home cook might make, and then would provide little explanations for how to save the recipe when things were going wrong. You know, if the butter was starting to burn, she'd tell you how to save that, and if the tarte tatin came out of the oven in a big pile of mush, how do you turn that into a beautiful apple dessert? And I think that was one of the things that people liked. But it was based on this foundation of rigorous technique and tremendous work so that it looked easy.
Well, one of the things people liked also was that you could trust these recipes. I don't know how many years has it been since the Mastering the Art of French Cooking was published, because I have a copy still make some of my favorite recipes from it, and they always come out perfectly.
Well, if you do what Julia says, it works out right. It actually came out in 1961, which was the year I was born. So
a lot of has changed in the cookbook world, and yet they have still remained pretty much of the moment. She leave a lot of did she leave you a lot of journals and letters that you could draw upon?
I had a big archive of things. The most useful things were these letters that she and Paul wrote to my grandparents.
The ones that were the original inspiration.
Because it was really like a running diary. It was remarkable. It was almost as if they knew they were going to become successful, and they were keeping this running diary going on a weekly basis, noting everything from the weather in Paris to what they were eating to the price of wine. And then Paul was working at the U.S. Embassy, and this was during the Cold War. And they would talk a lot with my grandparents about the state of geopolitics, and that was really fascinating too. It was a real slice of time in a very particular place.
Well, she couldn't talk much about the state of geopolitics with her own father, could she? Because they disagreed so much.
Indeed.
Did she grow up being liberal in a really conservative household, or was
she
that something that developed later?
In conservative Pasadena, California. Her father was a very rightward leaning businessman. Her mother was somewhat apolitical, I would say, very charming woman. But her father, John McWilliams, she was Julia McWilliams, they called him Big John, got more and more conservative with age and disapproved of her marriage with Paul. Julia, I think, had sort of liberal tendencies that began at Smith College and then were really amplified during the Second World War when she was posted by the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, to Ceylon, which we now call Sri Lanka. And that's where she met Paul Child. But they were in an environment of great intellectual ferment. I mean, the people that the OSS had there were not your typical soldiers. They were academics. They were spies. They were scientists. And in Paul's case, he was an artist, and his job was to design secret war rooms for Lord Mountbatten and giant maps and identification cards of enemy aircraft and so on. And so it was a real education for Julia to go there. And that gave her a love of intellectualism and pushed her politically leftward.
And she was quite outspoken about her views on McCarthy, the accusations of communism and of un-American activities in general, especially when Paul came under some suspicion.
Indeed. He was investigated while he was in the Foreign Service by Cohn and Schein, who were McCarthy's investigators. And he was called back to Washington without explanation, and he thought he was being called back to be given a promotion because he was well overdue for a promotion. He thought he would get a pay raise. And in fact, what happened was he was brought in and grilled by the McCarthy boys and humiliated. And it was the beginning of the end of his time in the Foreign Service. He was really disgusted by this. And Paul and Julia had many friends who were blacklisted by these guys unfairly. And you know, they saw the embassy bookshelves that were had books removed that the McCarthy boys didn't approve of, and it was a real time of almost political terrorism in a way that we don't have right at the moment, but certainly lurks in the shadows.
My guest is Alex Proudhon, who collaborated with Julia Child on her memoir, My Life in France. It is the subject of this month's book club, and you quoted her as calling you Dearie. We spoke with Bob Spitz last month about his biography of her called Dearie. I don't know if you've read it, but Dearie was what she called anyone she felt affection for?
Yeah, that's right. She never had kids of her own, and I like to think that she had a lot of surrogate children, and that meant everybody from famous chefs to people she met at the gas station who she would just invite over for dinner on random nights. And I've been to many dinner parties at her place where you would have this wonderful eclectic mix. Sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. But she was always up for an adventure. And if she felt close to you, she would call you Dearie. And it was really a nice kind of throwback phrase that she used.
Another phrase that appears a number of times in this book is tant pis.
Mm. Yeah, essentially it means too bad, you know, get over it.
And that's the way she seemed to approach this.
Very much. She had this very French attitude that, you know, one should be willing to take risks and make mistakes. And she always used to say, never apologize for your mistakes. And when people would start complaining, she would say, ah, tant pis, you know, get over it, move on. You know, and
which, of course, is what endeared people to her, the famous mistakes that she made during her cooking show. Other people would have edited them out. I guess she was doing them live, so she couldn't edit them out.
Yeah.
But
she was very natural and relaxed with it.
You felt like, well, she was doing what you might do if you knew
a bit
more.
I actually think that those things were sometimes the secret to her success, that people saw that even Julia Child wasn't always perfect and make mistakes. And she'd always say, well, if you're alone in the kitchen, who's to know?
She dropped something.
If she dropped her potato pancake on the stove, yeah. But sometimes I think she would make mistakes on purpose. And I mentioned the tart tatin earlier. There's an episode that's on the DVD, if people are curious to see, where she is making the tart tatin, which is a lovely apple dessert, caramelized apple dessert. And you're supposed to invert it when you bring it out of the oven. And on the show, she does invert it, and it comes out in a big, mushy mass of goop. And it looks like, you know, burnt applesauce, essentially. And she says, oh, that's a terrible mistake. Well, here's how you save it. And she puts a little confectioner's sugar on it, runs it under the broiler, and voila. You know, and I don't know, but I suspect that that was one that maybe she had done on purpose just to kind of keep people interested and keep them on their toes, because one of the great things about Julia is you never knew what was going to happen.
Now, she didn't grow up loving food. It was just one meal, we hear, the first one she and Paul ate in France the day they arrived in 1948, that was an epiphany for her.
That's right. She described it to me as the most important meal of her life. It was November 3rd, 1948, and they had come across the Atlantic from New York on the SS America through a terrible storm. They were two of only, I think, five or six people who didn't get sick on the ship. They arrived in Le Havre, the coast, and drove into Paris in their big blue Buick station wagon and stopped in Rouen along the way, the famous medieval town where they had this first luncheon of Julia's in France. And what you have to understand is she had never been to France before. Big John McWilliams, her father, had told her that the French men would pinch her derriere and that the women would be very snooty towards her. So she came in feeling a little bit intimidated. And what she discovered instead was that the waiter couldn't have been kinder, and he couldn't wait to tell her about everything on the menu. And then he and Paul got into a lengthy discussion in French about what sort of wine to have with lunch, and Julia had never heard of such a thing. They really had a great time. And then the wonderful aroma started coming out of the kitchen, and that put her at ease. And from that meal on, she fell in love with French food.
But there was good food in this country and good service in this country. Had she been unaware of it?
I think she'd been somewhat unaware of it. She had taken a cooking class designed for young women about to get married before she married Paul. Now, Paul had lived in France in the 20s. He knew people like Gertrude Stein and Hemingway. He was a gourmand back before that was popular in this country. He was a wine expert. And Julia felt unprepared, and so she took a little cooking class where she learned how to make things like pancakes. And that was really the extent of her knowledge. She came from a fairly well-to-do family where they had a cook, but she spent hardly any time in the kitchen, nor did her mother. And they ate meat and potatoes. And I think that was, as you say, you know, it was good American standard fare, but it was not haute cuisine.
Well, we had Le Pavillon in New York. There were other places.
There
but
were,
still.
But these were not places that Julia was exposed to.
And also, she discovered all those wonderful markets in France. And now we have green markets all over the place.
Right.
But they didn't exist at that time. And yet, all over Europe, they were just the norm.
That was one of her favorite things to do, was to shop in France. She loved fresh produce, and she loved the human interaction. And she said the difference between shopping in America and France is that it all relies on what she called les humaines relations, meaning that when you went to a French market, you don't just grab a piece of meat wrapped in plastic off the shelf and buy it in 30 seconds, as we do in the supermarkets here. You go and you talk to the butcher. But first you talk about the weather, and then you talk about his daughter, and then you say, well, what are you cooking at home? And in this way, you're building a relationship with the vendor, and then you're going to get the best pieces of meat, and you're going to learn his little techniques for how to prepare them. And she loved that, and that was one of the things that inspired her to pursue her career.
During these book club segments, we invite your comments. You can call us at 212-433-9692 or write to us at WNYC.org on our show page. Patricia from Westchester left this question on our show page. One of the photos in My Life in France shows Paul reading a newspaper with stacks of books nearby. Another shows Julia with a shelf of books above her head. What did they read for pleasure? And did they have favorite books and favorite authors?
I don't know about favorite books and authors, to be honest with you, but I know they read voraciously. They would get all sorts of American and French newspapers and magazines while they were living in Paris, and they continued to read those things when they came back to the States. They knew some of the writers. They were omnivores, really. They read fiction and nonfiction. Paul was very interested in language, and he would read books about language, and he would act as Julia's sort of writing tutor and mentor in the early days.
Because she had a wonderful, clear style.
Yeah, he helped her develop her speaking style, adapt it to the page. It's different when you're speaking and when you're writing. And writing didn't come naturally to Julia. It was difficult for her. And he really helped her. And in a way, they had it was almost like a Pygmalion relationship where he was the elder statesman, tutoring her. He was the one who brought her abroad and opened her eyes. And then when he retired from the Foreign Service, there was a switch. It happened to coincide with just the moment when her first book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, came out in the early 60s. And she then became the sort of senior partner, and he intentionally withdrew into the background but remained very, very important to her until the end. And she always said to me, you know, I couldn't have had my career were it not for Paul. And so the memoir is dedicated to Paul because even all these years later, she felt this great debt to him and great love for him.
We have some calls coming in. Our number 212-433-9692. Kiara from Ridgewood. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I just want to say your great aunt is a tremendous inspiration to me. I grew up watching her show, and then her show was Jacques Pepin towards the end of her life. I am now a line cook working in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on what your great aunt would have thought about how she sort of opened the profession of cooking up to women. I'm now the lead line cook at the restaurant where I work. And
at Roberta's?
No, not Roberta's. It's a place called Northeast Kingdom, okay. Not too far from Roberta's. But, you know, everyone in the kitchen just is so inspired by her recipes still today. And, you know, she really did open cooking up in a whole new way to the American audience, but also, you know, women could see themselves in a very professional role when it came to food. So I'm just wondering what she thought about her role in that, not just bringing food to people at home, but inspiring women to become professional cooks.
Now, when she went to France, most of the famous chefs were men, but there were restaurants where women also were.
Yeah.
And right
yeah.
now, I think one of the top chefs in all of France is a woman.
Yeah.
But when she went to cooking school, what was her goal? Just to learn how to cook better?
Yeah. Her goal was somewhat unformed. She loved going to all these restaurants, loved French food, and realized that she wanted to do it herself. And her first few experiments were terrible failures. I mean, she told me about making brains simmered with red wine for Paul, and it came out as a total disaster, and they went out to eat somewhere else afterwards. But in typical Julia fashion, she moved on. But to answer Kiara's question, I'm glad you brought that up because it was really important to her. She really felt that she wanted to bring women into the profession.
And was she a feminist, you think?
In her own way, I don't think she would have labeled herself that, but she certainly did a lot to promote women. She helped found the AIWF, the American Institute of Wine and Food, with Robert Mondavi, which was to designed to make food a more serious endeavor in this country and continues today. She was also a grande dame in the Les Dames d'Escoffier, which is an organization in this country specifically designed to get women into cooking. And, in fact, I was at an event last night with AIWF and Les Dames, and I was really pleased to see how robust their membership is and how enthusiastic everyone was about cooking and Julia's legacy, which it continues to inspire people, even, by the way, people who don't like to cook. They just they are sort of informed and entertained by her. But I think she would be very pleased, Kara, to see that you're the headline cook and that you know, that Bushwick is the new Paris.
Well, Brooklyn, right now in Paris, I'm told by a French friend, if you're very hip, they say, oh, you're so Brooklyn. But we are about to do an event with three celebrity chefs, and one of them is April Bloomfield.
Oh, great.
Along with Mario Batali and David Boulay. And New York has a number of women who are celebrity chefs now, something that probably would have been unheard of 40 years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, April won a James Beard Award last year, for example, and her book is fantastic. And she's an example of someone who grew up in a foodie family, not necessarily an easy upbringing, a very interesting personal story, and a wonderful restaurateur. And it's great to see people like that. And sometimes it takes kind of rugged individuals, whatever your gender, to survive in New York in any profession and in cooking in specifically, because it is very, very competitive. It's very difficult. My impression is that there are still some very subtle barriers there, but boy, are they coming down. And I think Julia would be pleased to know that she helped to start that process.
I don't know if she would have been as surprised as some were that her birthday just created the kind of sensation that it did. We remember the 100th birthdays of people we liked, but not with the kind of outpouring that we saw usually, as we saw with Julia. That was quite extraordinary.
It was amazing. I was lucky enough to be in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian, where her kitchen is now on display. And it's under renovation. They temporarily reopened it. And we had a little party there. And there were thousands of people who showed up. It was really fantastic, and people just couldn't wait to see the kitchen. And, you know, that exhibit was meant to be a temporary one, and it proved to be one of the museum's most popular exhibits and is now going to be the centerpiece for a whole new exhibit hall on food in America. But the Julia Kitchen will be the entry point to that whole new hall, and that'll be opening up this fall.
We don't have much time, but I want to sneak Mark in here. He has a question that a number of people have been asking. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I'm wondering why did Julia disapprove of the work of Julie Powell?
Well, you know, I know that was part of the movie, Julie and Julia. I never heard Julia Child in person say she disapproved of Julie Powell. I have to say, let's remember, she was 91 years old. She was constantly being bombarded by people wanting her time. And one of the trickiest things for me when I was working with her was that the phone was constantly ringing, or people would drop by and want to see her. And luckily, her secretary, Stephanie Hirsch, was able to kind of keep people at bay while we were doing our interviews. But it was stunning to me how much people wanted her time. And so I think that, you know, she always said to me, well, I just haven't read Julie Powell's blog, which is all it was at that point. And I think that was genuine. She just didn't have an opinion on because she hadn't read it. And
I've heard
so
that
it was nothing personal, really.
I've heard that you wrote your book, Ripple Effect, The Fate of Freshwater in the 21st Century, inspired after you shared a bottle of French mineral water with Julia Child.
That's right.
You have to do it, answer very quickly, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, we used to sit around in Santa Barbara talking and having lunch, and we'd often have French mineral water. And so I thought it would be an interesting idea to do an article about how the French view mineral water, which is a health additive, versus how we Americans view bottled water, which is as a quick and easy beverage. And Instead, I discovered that the world of water is fascinating, so that was my next book.
Today is the last day that you can register to win a copy of this book we've been discussing, My Life in France. When you sign up for the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club newsletter, go to our show page, sign up now. And also, in case you haven't read it, this is really just a wonderful book. It's called My Life in France, written by Julia Child with our guest today, Alex Prudhomme, and published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Merci.